Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray.
Hi, I'm Leighton Hewitt.
Hi, I'm Mats Wilander.
Hola, this is David Moreno, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, in association with Eurosport, and this week in association with David Moreno, whose voice you heard in the intro there. Thank you very much, David, for your input. David backed us very generously in our Kickstarter campaign, and as a reward, and as a reward for us as well, we now get to hear his dulcet tones in our intro today. It's
sounds
good,
better
isn't
than
it?
Us, doesn't he, really? And he certainly sounds better than all those other players that we had in the intro. Sorry, lads.
I like the international flavour. I think that's something that we can definitely take forward. Yeah. More international flavour.
And in fact, all the
and we know
intros,
how good you
now.
Are at, you know, accents and languages and pronunciations, David. So
yeah, I'm multilingual. I speak at least one language and Brummie.
You and Dan Evans both. We're back at the Putney Exchange, David. That's why there are some slightly unpleasant noises in the background, but we're delighted to be here. And we have mic cubes. I know it's not quite visible through the medium of radio, but do head to our social media channels where you can see our jazzy new microphone cubes. We are branded.
We are. I mean, we get some very strange looks in this particular place at the best of times with our microphones and having a conversation and looking pretty excited about life, as I always do. Catherine slightly less so. But when we're using branded Tennis Podcast microphones, crikey, it takes it up another level.
I look pretty excited about life today, I think. I was actually smiling as you said that. Somebody described me as caustic yesterday. That didn't go down well. Anyway, life generally is good now that we're back in the Putney Exchange, caustic or not. There's lots of tennis to talk about. Miami is over. The Sunshine Swing. I don't know where that name was born from, but it seems to have taken on sort of official status now, the Sunshine Swing being the term for Indian Wells and Miami.
I mean, I'm a bit concerned that the grass court swing in the UK might be relabeled the overcast swing or something.
Well, that would be a flattering term for it. Do you remember when it was like 39 degrees the other year, though? That's not going to work. Anyway, the Sunshine Swing is over. We've all got less sunshine in our lives now, apparently. Although it looks pretty sunny in Charleston and in Monterey, both delightful destinations, which is where the WTA Tour is this week. But yes, and we have champions. We have Joe Konta and we have Roger Federer, and we have so much to talk about with both of them, don't they? Should we start with Joe Konta, David?
I think we should.
She's quite good, isn't she?
She's pretty good. I mean, crikey. If you went back 2 years and told us in March of 2015 that Joe Konta would be world number 7 champion in Miami, having beaten Caroline Wozniacki for a second time in straight sets in the space of 3 months... I mean,
and talking bullishly about her intention to get to world number one. That's another big difference. We'll come on to that, I suppose, more in a minute. But that's a big difference as well. She's not trying to play down expectations anymore. She was very bullish after that win, saying, that's my goal now.
She was. We'll be hearing from Simon Briggs, the Telegraph's tennis correspondent, later in this show. I spoke to him from Miami about what Konta was like in the interview room and the other players that he's come across over the last couple of weeks. But she just exudes assuredness, self-assuredness in everything she does right now. I mean, that was the big surprise to me a couple of weeks ago in Indian Wells, is that she had a bit of a wobble. Her backhand, her most reliable shot, deserted her in Indian Wells. And I really did wonder whether... I don't want to overdo this and say the wheels might fall off, but it was a significant wobble. Then in the first round in Miami, she scraped past Alexandra Sasnovich in high winds. I mean, again, there was that big question mark. Is she going to get through? She won ugly, you're quite right. From there, I commentated for BT Sport on her match against Simona Halep, who is an excellent player, but she was so much more mentally strong than Simona Halep. We saw that wonderful on-court interview, on-court coaching segment with Darren Cahill, where you got the full insight to just what Halep was going through, the self-doubt.
We digress slightly to talk about Halep, but if you haven't seen that, please do go to YouTube or whatever. It's on the WTA website as well, to watch that coaching exchange between Darren Cahill and Simona Halep, because it is on-court coaching at its best, I think, a coaching relationship at its best, and an example of how insightful to the viewer the on-court coaching can be. I think it was everything that's great about on-court coaching. Please do watch it. But just bringing that back to Konta, the only thing in that exchange that Darren Cahill, who I thought was exemplary throughout, I mean, I've always had lots of time for him. We've spoken to him on the podcast before. Nobody really has a bad word to say about Darren Cahill, but I have even more time for him after watching that exchange and seeing how he operated in that high-stress situation. I was so impressed. But the only thing that really surprised me and took me aback about what he said was, he said, make it physical. You are physically stronger than her. Now, he could have been lying to Simona to boost her and make her believe in that moment, because that was a lot of the battle at that moment, to make her believe that she could win. But I think he was wrong there.
I think he was talking about movement, though. I don't think he was saying you are physically a stronger athlete, but movement-wise, I think she is the stronger player still than Jo Konta.
But he said make it long. He was talking about fitness. Well, make it long.
Honestly,
I don't think there's anyone fitter than Jo Konta. I really mean that.
Toe-to-toe, he was thinking, my player is getting knocked off the court here, and she needs to do something to take this out of Konta's hands. And he would have seen certain players, Sasnovich being an example of somebody who was able to just make her make errors eventually. And nobody moves better than Simona Halep in full flight, I don't think, on the women's circuit. She is so quick, so agile, so sort of able to run balls down. And I think that's what he was getting at in this instance. And incidentally, Martina Navratilova on the BT Sport coverage had been asked, you know, is this a top five player? A couple of rounds earlier, is this a top five player about Jo Konta? She said, not yet. At the moment, she's a top 10 player. And what will make her a top five player is better movement. Because at the moment, she still doesn't quite... She's a little stiff sometimes with her movement. If you take her out of her comfort zone and make her move diagonally into the forecourt, we've seen it against Sevastova at the US Open, players that can bring her in. Radvanska's done it to her before. I think that's what Darren Cahill was probably getting at.
Interesting.
But he had too much of a barrier to overcome there with Halep, because she decided that things weren't going to work out for her. I don't want to say she'd stopped trying, but she'd certainly stopped believing that things were going to go her way. It was like, it's not my day today. There's nothing I can do.
She said, I don't win matches like this. That was so interesting, wasn't it? She said, these are the matches I lose, the tight three setters, you know, this is what I do. I lose matches like this.
And the contrast is, again, on court coaching, is when Wim Fissette came on, having not come on the court at all throughout the first, couple of sets. He came on and he just walked up to Konta and he goes, how you doing?
Well, he gave her a high five, first and foremost. That was good, wasn't it?
The gist of it was, it's going from where I'm sitting, it's going really well, isn't it? And I thought, what a reassuring presence this guy is. He is judging this to perfection, Wim Fissette. And the reaction of Konta just getting basically just this little pat on the back, as if to say, yeah, you're doing as well as you think you're doing, just carry on.
Is there any more reassuring advice in the world than just, you're great, carry on doing what you're doing?
and I love the fact that he didn't try to impart any more information, because frankly there was no need. I mean, to look at the other matches she played, I didn't watch every ball of the Venus Williams match, but Venus Williams was playing really well. She has got the hold over Venus.
She does,
now.
Impressive, because Venus was her idol, of course. She really, she really has the better of that matchup. There was a part of me that was just a little bit disappointed that we didn't get to see Konta play Kerber. I'd have loved to have seen her.
Because that's one player I don't think she's beaten yet.
No, she hasn't. I think they've only played a couple of times before, and they certainly haven't played with Konta in this sort of, I'm reluctant to say form, because that suggests something that might wax and wane. I see it as sort of just a new person, a new different player. You know, it's only the second time she's played main draw in Miami.
It is
she only
remarkable.
Previously
it is truly
played
remarkable.
Collies. I mean, it's with both what happened in the men's and the women's this week, there are certain aspects of both stories where I struggle for the words to really sum up the significance and the unexpectedness, the genuine unexpectedness. And I don't mean few people expecting it. I mean absolutely nobody in the tennis world predicting these events coming. And I think that's glorious.
So, certainly not. I mean, I think perhaps at the start of Miami, you could have said Konta might win the title.
Oh, I mean a couple of years ago.
A couple of years ago. I don't know anybody. I mean, a couple of people I know have said, I thought she should be top 75 a lot earlier than she was and stuff like that. Personally, from my vantage point, and I'd seen her play a few times, I honestly thought she was pretty mentally fragile and would never overcome that. And I'm delighted to say I was completely wrong. A couple of other things.
David's got his phone out, everyone. I can see what he's trying to sneak in here. I should have seen this coming.
I mean, you know,
I've been duped.
Don't just expect something that I haven't yet said. However, I will be talking about a pole vault in a minute. But just on the subject of Konta, two other things. One is in the final she played Wozniacki, who I'd watched in a couple of matches throughout the week, who I think is playing superbly well at the moment, who's such a clever match player. I mean, the way she blunted Safarova a couple of rounds earlier, it was 2-love. She had points for 3-love 5 times, did Safarova. She was knocking her off the court. Wozniacki just changed her game completely, started to loop the ball to her backhand and just completely disorientated her.
But don't you think Wozniacki, I mean, I agree with you, I don't want to take anything away, she should have done that more against Konta, shouldn't she?
Yeah, I think so.
Slow-balled Konta. Nigel Sears actually referenced in commentary on BT Sport, didn't he, about a match that Konta played in Stanford en route to her first tournament win. Then Zheng Saisai, who was getting beaten quite badly and just decided to completely slow-ball her and just slice and dice and just give her no pace and no rhythm, and it completely threw her. Now, she's a better player than she was in Stanford, and she's stronger mentally and all the rest of it. But still, I think, yes, she tried a bit of that, but I think she perhaps could have tried a bit more
of
it.
Yeah, I would agree. The other thing that struck me straight after match point, to see her with the trophy, and I watched this final with my two kids, right? And at the end of it, I was watching Konta with a trophy. I heard what she said on court, and I thought, this woman is such a good role model. She is somebody I would like my daughter to look at and think, I want to be like that. In whatever walk of life, not just, I mean, I'm not saying my kids are going to be tennis players. If they've got anything like my talent, they could work night and day.
I'm saying nothing.
And just about break top 50. But in terms of, you know, just core values as a human being, as somebody who is making the absolute best of herself and doing it without any frills, without any sort of photo shoots necessarily, without just being the best tennis player and athlete and competitor and showing the best attitude that she possibly can, I think she is a credit. And I really am delighted to see somebody like that in the top 10 in the world and going higher.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, you tweeted yesterday and were quoted on the BBC Sport website, David. Don't think that didn't go unnoticed.
Oh, I didn't say that.
Oh, the BBC Sport website article, headline article, I might add, about Konta's victory. At the bottom, it had a full summary comment section from Russell Fuller, BBC's tennis correspondent, and then it had the views of a one-liner from Piers Newbury, the tennis website correspondent. I don't know what his official term is, something like that. Hello, Piers, if you're listening. And from Monsieur
just
David Law.
Listen to this rubbish.
and from Monsieur David Law. Right. So, yeah, people are hearing your opinion. You gazumped the podcast with your opinions. Anyway,
yeah. Can I give this poll?
No, you can't. I haven't even made my point, and can't even remember what it was.
Right. Well,
no,
I'll...
you said she could be. She is brilliant to see. I really hope she does something great on the grass and at Wimbledon, because she could be a great model and a role model. And I completely agree with you. I just took issue with you saying she could be a great role model. You've corrected that now, because she already is a great role model. It's just people need to take notice.
That's exactly what you've said. The only point I was making was that I would like this to be seen on a broader scale. The truth is, in this country, we are so one-eyed about what tennis is. And tennis, for so many people, somewhat understandably, is Wimbledon, the grass court season. Now, she's not got beyond the second round at Wimbledon.
She has had tough draws.
But just imagine if Jo Konta was deep into the second week of Wimbledon. Imagine that. And frankly, there's no reason why she shouldn't be. She's got the perfect game for grass.
I think she can beat anybody but Serena. I'm convinced that she has a very good chance as the player she is now, and I believe she will still improve because that's in her nature. She has a very good chance against anybody but Serena. Yeah. That doesn't mean she wouldn't have a chance at all against Serena. I just think look, she did well against her in Australia, but
she got beaten handily
in Australia.
Look, Serena is the greatest tennis player of all time. And when she's on and when she's up for it like she was in that match to teach somebody a lesson, sorry, nobody's got a chance.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
Anyway, what I was saying,
he's got his phone out again. I thought we'd averted.
No, sorry about that. The fact of the matter is, and there is still 2 hours and 48 minutes as we speak left to vote on this. Depends on when you listen to it. Serena Williams is 35 years of age, right? She's not going to go on forever, no matter how great she is. Jo Konta's only 25. Jo Konta will, win a slam, reach world number one, do both, do neither. What do you think, Catherine? 1,171 votes. What do you think?
I think she'll win a slam, definitely. I mean, definitely, that's probably a bit strong. I think she'll win a slam and she might get to number one. I think on balance, probably, I think she'll get top five, definitely. If I had to commit now, I'd say slam, but not quite number one.
Okay, well,
I'll ask Rosie at the weekend.
Yeah, well, Rosie, if you haven't seen our tennis podcast, has done her own prediction for the Miami final and she nearly nailed it. She did a pretty, pretty good job managing to get the right winner, at least.
I think she did nail it. It's just I didn't nail my interpretation of her...
The number of sets.
Of her behaviours, yeah.
Yeah.
What she was trying to say was it'll be a bit more competitive than it was in Indian Wells, I think. A lot of you probably have absolutely no idea what we're talking about. Go to our Instagram or Facebook page. Rosie is the new Paul the Octopus, who did World Cup predictions.
In hindsight, she was definitely saying Federer in two. Catherine misread it.
Anyway, basically, Rosie's replacing pole vault in the prediction section of the podcast.
To pole vault. So anyway, 48% of the people think that Jo Konta will win a slam. 16%.
48% of the respondents, David, not of all the people.
Well,
16%
think that she will do both. So, you know, basically, what's that? 64%.
Well, of course, she's a lot more likely to do one if she does the other.
64% think she will definitely win a slam.
2,000 points right there, isn't it?
31% think she will do neither.
Right.
I think she'll do both.
Illuminating.
I think she'll do both.
Do you?
Yeah.
You and 16% of the respondents.
Yep. So, anyway, what else have we got to talk about?
Roger Federer.
Oh, yeah.
Put your phone away, David, and we'll talk about Roger Federer.
Okay,
he deserves your full attention because he's quite good
isn't he? He is quite good, isn't he? Not bad for 35. And, I mean, you know, he took 6 months off, everybody. 6 months off, putting his feet up, going around the world. Then he comes out and he wins the Australian Open. He wins Indian Wells and now he's won Miami. I mean, first of all, we have to say that he hasn't faced in that period Andy Murray or Novak Djokovic. That's not his fault. He's beaten whoever has been put in front of him, and he's taken advantage of their misfortune and their lack of form, their lack of fitness. But even if they were there, the form that he's been in versus the form they've been in, he would still be winning those matches. And what he has done to Nadal three times this year now, I mean, OK, it was very close in the final in Australia, and don't forget, Nadal was a breakup in that final set, but since then, my goodness, he is just taking Nadal apart. And I don't think Nadal had a clue what he could do. I mean, I don't think it was just... I think he was playing pretty well, I thought, Nadal. He can no longer rely on that cross-court forehand into the Federer backhand. It is a tactic that has become pointless, it seems.
Yeah, well, I think, obviously, he was burned badly by what happened in Indian Wells and tried to do things differently in Miami yesterday, but all that did was give Federer an opportunity to say, oh, my forehand's still quite good, though. I know you've all been talking about my backhand, and yes, that's great, but the forehand is still good as well. And, I mean, the stats back this up on the forehand. There's been a downward trend on the percentage of points that Federer has won on his forehand since his pomp, his peak, let's say 04 to 06. It was all about the Federer forehand, wasn't it? And since then, the percentage of points Federer wins on his forehand has been going steadily down. Well, he bucked that trend completely in both Indian Wells and Miami. Yes, the backhand is still great, but the problem is, I mean, I guess part of the reason for that is players are no longer thinking they can play all the sort of defensive shots into his backhand. That's not an option anymore. There's nowhere left to attack. So he probably is getting more on the forehand, and he's dealing with them handily. I mean, where do you attack Roger Federer? What do you do? What would you do?
if
you don't have Nick Kyrgios's serve and attitude, and we'll come on to that match in a minute. If you don't have Nick Kyrgios's serve, and only Nick Kyrgios has Nick Kyrgios's serve, what on earth do you do to attack Federer? I mean,
ask Evgeny Donskoy. That's what I'd do. And then try to get his skills, because he beat him.
The only
man to beat him this year. Look, no, I mean, that. I'm being ridiculous. The fact of the matter is that Federer was partially tuned in for that match and he lost it. I'm not trying to be unkind to Donskoy. Look, I don't know what
you can do. I think Evgeny Donskoy might admit that Roger Federer is, on balance, overall a better tennis player than him.
I think he probably would be generous enough to do that. I don't know what you do, Catherine, because you watch the way he plays now. One of the questions we asked was slightly jokingly, if Federer of 06 played Federer of 17, what did you like that one?
Would he beat Rod Laver, David?
No, I mean,
would he beat Ken Rosewarne?
We'll get on to that.
Look, I won't engage with who would beat who because tennis changes and balls changes and all of that. I will say Roger Federer now is a better player than he has ever been. I firmly believe that.
Okay, now I would agree with you in terms of the things he can do. I think athletically, is he quite as good as he was back then? Who is at 35?
Give me examples. Don't just assume he's not as good because of...
I've seen some highlights from a few matches back then, and, I mean, he must have lost something physically.
But I don't see any points that he seems to lose because he's a step slower.
The thing is, you don't see him play those sort of points anymore.
Well, no, exactly. So you play to your strengths, don't you?
No, listen, what he's added, it seems to me at least, is this ability to run diagonally across the court and just take the opponent's shots on the half volley, no matter where he puts them. And he's immediately putting pressure on. Back then, he didn't need to bother. he just didn't bother learning how to do that because he could just sort of, you know,
just
spar with
them
at the baseline and then beat them at their own game. And athletically, he was superior. Now it seems to me that Djokovic and Nadal brought a physicality that the old Roger Federer couldn't actually beat just doing that. He's had to develop his own game in order to beat them. And suddenly, I mean, I think Djokovic, we still have to hold fire a little bit because, you know, Djokovic has won most of their recent matches. But coming out of this six-month layoff, he is, as I say, just putting such relentless pressure on. He takes the game away from people. It's mind-boggling what he's doing.
And he's now going to take a six-week holiday, which sounds just delightful. And we're not going to see him again until the French Open because Well, long breaks have proven to be quite effective for Roger Federer. Reason number one. Reason number two, he doesn't really think he can win the French Open, so he doesn't want to invest too much in
the
clay court season.
I mean, if he comes out there fresh, just winging it...
I'm not writing Roger Federer off for anything at the moment. Of course he could win the French Open. It's less likely than him winning anything else, but I mean, it's Roger Federer and it's 2017, so anything stranger things have happened. And reason number three, sorry, just before we get lost in David Law's quick notes, he said that he actually thinks playing on the clay last year was a contributing factor to his eventually becoming injured. He's eventually becoming injured at Wimbledon. I know he'd already had the surgery by then, but he thinks he aggravated it on the clay, and he doesn't want to risk doing it. He's just not taking any risks, and why would you?
No, I think you know, you can't argue with it. And we had the same conversation about Serena, didn't we, a few weeks ago? It's rough on the tour in a way that they're effectively saying, I'm not going to bother with X and Y. I'm just going to go to the majors. But look, they've earned the right, and tennis would be poorer without them. So the tours, frankly, have just got to go with it and celebrate what they have got of their time. And obviously in Miami and Indy Wells, in Federer's case, that's a fabulous couple of victories for Roger Federer. Just a quick note on Nadal. It gets kind of lost, I think, inevitably, just how good a season he's having because of the victories that Federer is having against him and the way he's turned that rivalry around. But Rafael Nadal fans should not despair, because this is a good start to the season for him. He is the second best player in the world this year. So I suppose you might argue, well, what about Kyrgios? He's not far off. But in terms of results posted, you've got Nadal there in second place in the road to the end of the year, the ATP World Tour Finals. And this is still not his best surface yet. Get him on clay, playing like this, well, the omens are good, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, who else is there? Who else is there, really, that you're looking at on the clay and going, you're going to win the French, or you've got a very good chance of winning the French? Of course, anybody could. There are names you could throw in there. But who else are you looking at going, you have a really good chance of winning the French?
There's no obvious clay courter that's playing so well on the hard court that they're a shoe-in for doing well, that you automatically think, oh, that guy. You know, I think Kyrgios and Zverev could do well on the clay. I think Federer could come in cold and do well. Djokovic...
Team could come in very, very warm and do well.
Oh, well, I do think he could do really well.
He could,
but,
yeah.
Look, Nadal must be the favourite for the French Open.
Oh, I think that's without question. I reserve the right to change that once we've seen Djokovic come back. We'll see him at Davis Cup this weekend. We'll see him in Monte Carlo.
I loved the tweet from Boris Becker about Novak Djokovic midway through the final. Through the semi-final between Federer and Kyrgios. And Becker said, come on, Novak. Time to dust off those shoes and fix that racket and get back out there.
Yeah, well, I loved that tweet too, and I thought, yeah, great, good stuff, Boris. And then he's slightly discredited himself with a tweet about Andy Murray yesterday, sort of going, what's going on? Our world number one is MIA. What are you doing, Andy, or something? I was like, this bloke's injured, Boris. You should understand injury better than anyone.
I did wonder whether he'd been hacked at that point.
I did too. He has been hacked recently, and it, in quite unpleasant circumstances, poor bloke. So, yeah, no, I really like that too. I did really smile when I saw that, but I rather raised an eyebrow when I saw the Andy Murray related tweet. I think he's just stirring things up, isn't he?
Can we talk about Nick Kyrgios now?
He's just David. You should do a separate podcast about Nick Kyrgios.
Well, come on. Look, what do you think?
I think he's great. I think that was one of the best tennis matches I've ever seen. Federer, one of the best three-set tennis matches I've ever seen. There were no dips in the level. No dips at all.
That was impressive, wasn't it? After he lost that first set, for him not to go away was pretty instructive, I thought.
And I thought it was Kyrgios at his best in all respects. And I know you're going to want to talk about the crowd treatment. I think the crowd treatment of him was completely out of order, because I didn't see any of the over-the-line behaviours from Kyrgios. Look, he was controversial, he was brattish, and he was all those things. But I think he was on the right side of the line all the time, and the crowd calling out and so on when he was about to serve and hit shots, completely out of order. And I don't know why they were... booing him at certain moments, because I really think he was at his very best. And it's funny, playing Federer, I remember talking at the Australian Open after his loss to Seppi. And look, I am a Kyrgios fan, which is why I care so much about him wanting to stay on the right side of the line and not do tanking and stuff. We talked... I was quite outspoken after his loss to Seppi in Australia, because what annoyed me so much was that he's... we know that he wants to be cool, you know, he wants to be seen as cool. And that's fine.
Don't
he's a young
all.
Guy. He's a young guy. Well, some of us are more successful than others. You know, he changes his shoes into those snazzy young person trainers after the match. You know, being cool is important to him, and that's fine. But he saw it, my interpretation was, he saw it as uncool to look like you're trying too hard, you know, uncool to put all your effort in it and leave nothing out. You know, he just wanted to look like he didn't care as quite as much as everyone else, and that really bothered me. Well, playing Federer out there that day, it showed him that, you know, Federer is the coolest man in the world, according to GQ magazine. There is nothing uncool about trying, and it really seemed like Nick Kyrgios understood that during that match, and I loved seeing that. He was going to leave, and did leave, absolutely everything out there. I thought, actually, on the whole, he dealt with some rough treatment from the crowd pretty well. I mean, obviously he lost his temper a bit, but I think I would have lost it. I think they were pretty out of order quite a lot of the time, and we need to appreciate him when he is at his best and when he does stay on the right side of the line, because that's the Kyrgios that can be brilliant for tennis and deserves to be appreciated.
Agreed wholeheartedly with that. I would also add that that was the culmination of a number of matches in which I felt he showed that great attitude. He spoke really, really well after his victory, I think, over Ivo Karlovic, which was such a tough match to win. You know, Karlovic, he had four or five break points in the second set, and Karlovic just didn't let him get near the ball. And at the end of the match, he spoke to Marcus Buckland on Sky Sports, and he just said, look, I just want to fight for every point. And it feels to me like the penny has dropped in that regard. Hewitt has finally got through. He's possessed Kyrgios and managed to get that message over to him. And he has made, I think that there is almost a rite of passage for certain people to discover that trying hard is cool. And leaving everything out there is cool.
Roger Federer is the perfect example of that. I do think he is helping with that, because I don't think anybody could accuse Roger Federer of not being cool, perhaps with the exception of when he wore that jacket at Wimbledon. I did not think that was cool. But in every other moment of Roger Federer's life, he has been cool.
Has your opinion now changed from a few weeks ago when I categorically said that Nick Kyrgios would win a Grand Slam, and you categorically said that he would
I'm feeling less. I'm pleased to say that I'm erring in that opinion, but it's a couple of tournaments. We need to see. I want to see.
So him. Yes or no?
I'm not changing it yet. I'm reevaluating it. To be continued. I want to change it in the future. I would love nothing more than Nick Kyrgios to win slams, to reach number one, to be a force in tennis. I can't change my predictions every week based on, you know, you told me off for assessing Dominic Thiem after losing early in Miami. You said, just wait for Roland Garros and the clay court season and all of that. So I'm just going to wait for Nick Kyrgios. But I hope I will be modifying that prediction. I've seen enough to think maybe I will be in the future, and that's great.
Yeah, it is great. I loved watching that match. I mean, you know, I was looking around for people in my little office at 3 a.m. to high five. I was on my own. But anyway, it was a treat. It was just, you're right, it was one of those matches. I finished watching it and thought, I want to watch it again.
I did watch it. I watched parts of it twice. And also, I mean, it was rather eclipsed by the match that came after it, but Kyrgios Zverev was pretty good as well, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean, Zverev was fantastic as well. And the atmosphere between those two, they fist bumped before the match started, you know, at the net. They obviously get on famously.
And you had Kyrgios telling Zverev, you might want to challenge that, mate.
Yeah,
I mean, that was great. Yeah,
I mean,
it was great.
That's fantastic. And I think he overdoes some of the feeling of persecution sometimes about all that as well. I kind of get it, but the fact of the matter is, as long as we are fair as a media, I think we people jump very quickly on his failures and his failings, and there have been a number that have been unacceptable. But I think that we all need to be fair and give him just deserves for when he does the right thing, and he's done many of those in the last few weeks.
Agreed. He's already back in Australia because he's playing Davis Cup in Brisbane this weekend. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first of all, we'd better hear from Simon Briggs because we're getting kicked out of another establishment, David.
Don't these people realise who we are?
I know. We've got branded mic cubes and people still
and
have
everything.
The audacity to kick us out of their establishments. I think we've got about 8 minutes left in this Costa Coffee. We will use that to just look ahead a little bit to the Davis Cup. But first and foremost, David's had a chat with Simon Briggs, who's out in Miami experiencing all of the wonderful stuff that we've just talked about firsthand. And he's got a lot of insight as a result. And David has spoken to him and got all of it for you listeners on the Tennis Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
So, Simon, you will have just come straight out of, I guess, the press conferences following that men's singles final. How were the players' moods? I mean, it's such a strange situation having Federer and Nadal matches again after 3 years of not having many of them. And here they are in the final. And Federer, I mean, he's lost one match.
Well, yes, Roger was pretty happy. Rafa was pretty glum. I guess that's not a huge surprise. It didn't help that the first question to Rafa was, congratulations on your win.
Oh, dear.
Which seems to have been a bit of a running theme in press conferences in the last couple of years. We've had a few misfires from some people who have media accreditation who perhaps shouldn't. Anyway, that was not the ideal start. After that, he tried to gather himself and try to sound upbeat, but I don't think he's particularly enjoying that sense of not really knowing what he's trying to do out there. His forehand patented method of attack to the high Federer backhand, there were a couple of points that actually had that sort of rhythm, except that it was as if the polarities were reversed, because it was the high backhand was dominating Rafa's forehand along that diagonal. And that's a pretty extraordinary shift at this late stage of their rivalry. So, yeah, he's pretty crestfallen. And also having... How many finals has he played here? Was that the fifth?
Yeah.
And still not come away with the title. It's obviously hard to swallow.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, if you were to look at his results this year in isolation without comparing them to Roger Federer's, you'd say actually Nadal's having a good season. I mean, this is probably his best start in years, but because his old rival has turned the tables on him so dramatically and just dominated the narrative of the whole year so far, it kind of feels underwhelming by comparison, doesn't it? I mean, what was Federer's mood like? I mean, obviously one would expect him to be pretty joyous, but I mean, he seems quite shocked to me that this is even happening himself.
Well, the first thing that happened when he walked into the press conference was everybody applauded raucously.
I didn't, because
it's not part of the unwritten code of the assembled tennis hacks. You're not supposed to do that. And Roger said, "You aren't supposed to do that, actually, but thank you."
Yeah.
I mean, he knows as well as us that's not supposed to happen. Miami does have a slightly eclectic cast of people in the press conference and the media room sometimes.
Is there any circumstance by which you think applauding in a press conference is acceptable?
I suppose I might make an exception for retirement, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking this. I read about that on social media just now, and I was thinking the only time I felt really that it was appropriate was, say, at the end of Andy Roddick's final press conference at the US Open. That's the only thing I could think of. But, you know...
I mean, if it's somebody who has given an awful lot to the sport and has given a lot, you know, professionally to the people like me who, you know, we are sort of... a secondary layer of employees who make their living from the circuit, so we do rely on the players, and we're sort of feeding off them in a sense, aren't we? So the ones who go out of their way to be helpful and insightful and make time, I think that's certainly something which I would not object to at a retirement press conference. But I think winning a title, Roger put it himself, pointed out that it wasn't actually the done thing.
Yeah, well, he knows the business better than anybody, really, from years having been in it. He has won three titles now, and he dropped that bit of news right into his TV interview at the end there that's it, really, until the French Open.
Yes, so he explained later that he's off for 10 weeks. Well, that's an interesting bit of math. He's either added up wrong or he actually isn't even convinced he's going to play the French Open, because as I make it... 8 weeks to the French Open. I said, you know, is it about the grass court season? Is it a question of prioritising that? And his first response was sort of, no, it's more just because I need prevention for injuries. I need to get back in the gym and start doing the exercises that help me get fit for the start of the season. But then he was sort of pressed on this a bit more as the interview went on, and he did kind of slightly soften his position and start to admit that really Wimbledon is the priority and it's not actually until sort of we go into June that he starts to feel that the season's really underway.
Yeah, well, I think the only thing is it could actually make him dangerous at the French Open. I mean, you could just imagine him coming in fresh to that with no expectations. I'm not saying winning it, but my goodness, you wouldn't want to face him, would you? he's just proved that, really, with the way he's come off that 6 month layoff. So... what about the tournament as a whole? I mean, you have obviously seen an incredible crescendo to it, but from a British perspective, a first British woman winning the title there ever. Extraordinary in its own right.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you'd actually sat down at the start of the tournament and said what's going to be the most eye-catching results, then we have got exactly, from a British perspective, what's... we would have asked for, I suppose. It's all the more extraordinary when you consider that we were arriving in the middle of the first week, and the first day that we actually arrived on site, the other four British players in the draw all lost, leading us to resort to a fair amount of gallows humour about what the hell we were going to fill the next 10 days with. But it all worked out extremely well. And obviously for Johanna Konta, an incredible next step along this development, which just continues to climb. It's not so much... as if she's going forward. It's more like she's on a sort of the stairway to heaven tennis-wise, isn't it? And you wonder if that's going to be something that's going to end with a Grand Slam title.
She's obviously going to get a lot of attention now in the coming months. I noticed she was on the front page of the Sunday Times today, for instance. How do you think she's going to handle that? When we start getting in towards Wimbledon and the attention really picks up, what do you think, from your dealings with her, how you think she'll get on?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, I think you pointed out on Twitter as well, that because she's never had a good Wimbledon, she hasn't necessarily been as much of a sort of talking point in the build-up to the tournament in previous years. Will this change that? It may depend what happens in the next 2 months, because if she does have a quiet clay court season, then for all the fantastic excitement that we've enjoyed here and the front pages that she's had, if we go back into the grass court season and she's had a quiet clay court season, then I'm not sure that she will still be up there at the forefront of the sporting agenda. And people will be sort of being introduced to her again come the grass. If she carries on and is, you know, carrying all before her for the next couple of months, then there will be an awful lot of noise and fuss.
Yeah.
So, but that'll be obviously a nice problem to have. But she's, if nothing else, she has this extraordinary determination to deal with all the new issues that are sort of thrown up and to adapt herself. That's how she's managed to get to here in the first place. She was a slow learner, maybe in the early days of her WTA tour career, or perhaps her ITF tour career, when she was trawling around the $25,000 tournaments or the $75,000 tournaments for 4 or 5 years before making a real impact. And then she's just assembled all the pieces of the puzzle, and now there's no stopping her. So it's possible she might have a year of or a moment maybe in the English season when it all becomes too much and she has a sort of a moment of anxiety that we might recognise from her earlier career. But you wouldn't put it past her to just sail on regardless, given how far her mental strength has come on in the last 2 years.
Yeah, she just keeps accumulating experience, doesn't she, and seems to handle it with great, aplomb. It's very impressive. Another person who seems to be learning in a number of ways is Nick Kyrgios. How have you found him over the last couple of weeks and his strides?
Yes, well, the semi-final against Roger Federer couldn't have been much more of a test for his equanimity, the way it ended with the... It wasn't quite the penultimate point. It was technically the anti-penultimate point, wasn't it? When the line call was made from the stands, he was trying to hit a forehand. Somebody shouted out, and whether that was a factor in him missing the shot, he certainly felt that he'd been put off. You know, he could have gone into the press conference after that moment and whinged, but instead he took it on the chin, really, and said, after the career Roger's had, you have to expect he'll be the crowd favourite and I have to win more matches to deserve that status. And that was a very mature response from a man who was, I know he was feeling pretty beaten up inside by the way it finished. So that was a big step forward in the whole of this sunshine double, if you like, to call these two American hardcourt tournaments, has shown us a different Kyrgios, a man who is playing point by point. He's still throwing in tweeners, but in fact when he plays the tweeners he seems to be winning more often and turning them into assets rather than, you know, liabilities. So he's really been certainly the behind Federer, he's been the player of this month, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He probably was the second best player here. I'm not sure Rafa on the form we saw him today would have stopped Kyrgios in the final. And clearly he might have gone further in Indian Wells, but for the food poisoning he picked up in the middle of the tournament. So he's been still fascinating, still controversial, but certainly better behaved, more controlled, and playing electric tennis. So fantastic news for the tour and for anybody who enjoys watching him.
Yeah. Now, you've got a busy few weeks coming up, haven't you? Because it's Davis Cup virtually straight away, isn't it? When are you off to France?
Yeah, I'm going to France Tuesday, so.
Simon, we speak to each other here at the moment on Sunday night, straight back over to the UK, then pack the bags again, off on Tuesday, Davis Cup. And then you've got there's Fed Cup later in the month, and then there's also Stuttgart and Maria Sharapova's return. I noticed quite a few column inches were being filled with various players' reactions to her situation over the last week. Anybody stood out?
Yeah, certainly Barbara Strichova, I think, has taken it to a different level of analysis. I thought she was very impressive in the way that she articulated her feelings. Strichova has been banned for a stimulant in 2013, which she ingested via a weight loss supplement, came back at Stuttgart herself, worked her way up, lost in qualifying the first round. So it was very well placed to talk about that experience, about the difference between training and playing matches, and also about her frustration maybe that the rules are being bent for Sharapova. She said that it doesn't have anything against Sharapova herself, but feels like the WTA Tour were going overly out of their way to invite her back at a tournament where she wasn't eligible until the third day of the main draw. Some of the other tennis agents have pointed out to me that while there is no specific rule in the WTA handbook about the situation, you could perhaps extrapolate from the age restriction rule, which says that if you're turning 14, which is the minimum age for playing in a WTA tournament, you've got to do it before the tournament starts. So there's a sort of a potential equivalence one could draw here with the situation of coming back from a ban.
Very, very interesting. So you've got a busy month coming up. First of all, just very quickly, Simon, Davis Cup, Britain, I imagine, pretty heavy underdogs in your view.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a piece I think Simon Cambers did with Patrick Mouratoglou today, in which Mouratoglou was saying that it's possible that the French could be made anxious by the extent to which they're such heavy favourites. And point, you know, there's always a chance that Kyle Edmund can upset people on clay. It's his best surface. He's potentially a very difficult player to deal with if he gets his game going because of the incredible power he's got on his forehand side. So, you know, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. It could be close. It's probably asking too much to expect Great Britain to go through, but if they can make it competitive, that'll be something.
Yeah, and just finally, any word on Andy Murray's fitness at the moment and likely return?
Not really. I mean, they're still talking about this match for Africa 3 that Federer is meant to be playing in Zurich on April the 10th against Murray, and there's been no withdrawal at this stage. You know, we were told that he's got a tear in his elbow. That could cover a multitude of scenarios depending on the size of the tear itself. You know, Leon Smith still hopeful that Andy might be able to get back in time for Monte Carlo. That would be a pretty best-case scenario, I think. But he's got great medical staff around him, so you wouldn't rule it out.
No, you wouldn't. Well, Simon, thanks for talking to us, as always, here on the Tennis Podcast. Go and have a good trip back home, and then, yeah, make sure you're packing your bags sharpish after that.
Thanks, David. See you soon.
Cheers.
So that was Simon Briggs. Very interesting to hear firsthand what it was like out in Miami, how the players were in press conferences. You know, it was I think it's one of those tournaments that, I mean, obviously from a British perspective with Joe Konta, it will be memorable. I think it really, really will be memorable. I think, I mean, to be honest, all of 2017 is probably going to be memorable. I mean, goodness knows what else can happen. What's going to happen in the immediate term, certainly on the men's side, is Davis Cup quarterfinals. Now, you're on a time limit here, David. There's no time for pole vault. We are going to get turfed out of the Putney Exchange soon. What's going to happen?
I have no idea.
First of all, let's go through this strategically, given our time constraints. We have France versus GB in Rouen, and I just want to revise some slightly disparaging things that I said about Rouen in a previous podcast, because I've been reminded by my dad that actually I went to Rouen as a kid and it was lovely, and actually it was somewhere that Monet painted a lot of his best work because it was such a beautiful and inspiring place. So sorry to Rouen and all residents therein. Are France going to win that tie?
just quickly, who won Wimbledon, Whittaker Wimbledon?
Oh, we should never talk about Whittaker Wimbledon again. We played some family doubles and it was low quality, and my dad just seemed sort of disdainful that he was having to
lower himself. Right. I say, who's going to win? I think France are going to win, but it'll be on the final day. I think Britain will take it to a final day. I think it might even go to a fifth rubber. The chances are France will win.
I'd agree with that. I think Kyle Edmund might win a rubber
and
on the clay.
The doubles is winnable too for Britain because they have a very good doubles pairing.
Yeah, so do France though.
Well, they've got injuries though. Herbert is out, so you know.
Oh, any opportunity for David Lord to say Herbert? Do you want to do it one more time?
Herbert.
Have you noticed? I tweeted this, by the way, that Cardinuni pronounces Kerber as Kerber.
I know. That is just clearly, I want to sound cool saying this.
Do you think it is? I don't know. I need a German person to tell us whether that's accurate. Belgium versus Italy at the Spludodrome de Charleroi Spirudome de Charleroi.
You're just saying that repeatedly,
in Belgium,
aren't you? To sound cool.
Belgium with Goffin, Darcy, Bemelmans, and Italy with Fabio Fognini, fresh from his semi-final run in Miami, Paolo Lorenzi, Andrea Seppi, and Simone Bilelli.
So
there's another bloke for Belgium that I've never heard of.
What surface?
Joris de Lura.
Yeah, all right. What surface?
Indoor hard court.
Belgium.
What else have we got? We've got Serbia with Novak Djokovic playing Spain, a rather depleted Spain. I think their number one is Pablo Carreño Busta.
Oh, he's playing well.
Yeah, he is playing well. Albert Ramos Vinola, Mark Lopez, and then somebody else I've never heard of, João Munar.
Yeah.
And Djokovic have got, Serbia have got Djokovic, Trojki, Lajovic. They're going to win, aren't they? Yeah,
well,
indoor hardcore in Belgrade.
Yeah, okay.
Serbia are going to win that. Australia versus USA. Oh. Inform Kyrgios against Inform Sock at the Pat Rafter Arena in Brisbane. Who's
fantastic.
Got that one?
Brisbane, Pat Rafter Arena. I'm going for Australia.
You say that as if that's any kind of surprise. I don't think
it is.
Well,
hold on a minute. Look at, you know, if you look at Australia without Bernard Tomic, without Tanasi Kakanakis.
Yeah, but Kyrgios will win both his singles rubbers,
that's
I think,
a
and
bit
then
of an
Groff,
assumption.
Groff Pears will win the doubles. There
I'm going for the US.
You just said you're going
I've
for Australia.
Changed my mind.
You're a contrarian, David. And then, oh, that's it.
Okay, well, there we are then.
We've done it.
Right. Oh, it's a good job because the bloke is literally about to walk over right now.
We've completed tennis. We've completed. David's got. I'll of course get Rosie's.
He's showing me the keys.
I'll get Rosie's views on who's going to win those ties, and we'll be back next week. We've been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with the Telegraph and with Eurosport and with David.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Moreno, we'll be back.